A reading from the Gospel of John. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem, by the Sheep Gate, there is a pool called Hebrew Bethesda, which has five porticos. In these lay many ill, blind, lame, and paralyzed people. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The ill man answered, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm making my way, someone else steps down in front of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." And at once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was a Sabbath. This is the gospel of grace. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. And thank you for your gracious invitation. It is good to be with you this morning. A disclaimer, I haven't been in the pulpit for 5 years. I'll be explaining in a moment where I have been, as if it might matter to you. But I can tell you that several greeted me in the narthex and said, "It's good to have you here." And I said, "Well, don't speak too soon." 5 years is a long time, and it's easy to grow a bit rusty, so we'll see how this goes. I worshiped with you on Ash Wednesday, which you might recall coincided with Valentine's Day, and Ryan had a wonderful line that night. He said, "Nothing says love like having ashes smashed into your face and being told you're going to die." Yeah, I often quote Ryan, and that's a memorable one. But actually, it wasn't the first time that I was told that I was going to die. 6 years ago, a doctor laid it out for my wife Jackie and me. "It's terminal," he said. "You have 2 years, maybe more, with treatment." So we applied for life-saving surgery. We were denied. We appealed. We were denied again. And so we appealed over and over and over across the country. Surgeons declined us. And then 4 years ago, when the treatment was no longer working, I went on hospice. I laid in a hospice bed for 3.5 years. And then shockingly, last summer, we answered the phone to learn that the University of California, San Diego, had accepted us. The surgery was in October, and here we are. Well, if Jon Stewart can return to The Daily Show, perhaps I can return to David Letterman's top 10 lists. What follows then is a David Letterman-style top 10 list of the things that I have learned when I was dying. Number one, be thoughtful when speaking of miracles. The moment we label someone's recovery a miracle, we face the perplexity that not everyone gets a miracle. John says that at the pool of Bethesda there were many invalids, and yet Jesus approached a solitary man, ill for 38 years. Was he somehow more worthy than the others at the pool that day? And Jesus asked that pointed question, "Do you want to be made well?" Now there's a question. I know a woman of whom it was said, she's a hypochondriac blessed with bad health. Sometimes the predictability of illness overwhelms the hope of health, and people become stagnant and frozen. I understand. In my case, hope for a cure dissolved into a trust that God would care for me in death and for my family after it. It wasn't that I wanted to die, and it wasn't even that I had chosen to die. It was simply that I had become comfortable with the idea of dying. We do not understand why some prematurely die and some, like me, receive inexplicably a second breath. But I know two things. First, I'm reluctant to throw around the word miracle because I'm not certain that I believe in miracles. Oh, sure, I have no doubt that the Creator of the universe is quite capable of intervening in the history and lives of human beings. But God seems to do so in exceedingly rare circumstances. But second, I have skirted death so many times as my health failed that I'm hard-pressed to find any other explanation for what's happened to me. And so with great care, I will use that word miracle. I realize that it is a paradox to say that I'm not sure I believe in miracles, and yet I received one. I realize that this is a paradox. The mystery of God's mercy can send us only to our knees in prayer, and the ubiquity of God's generosity can lead us only to our feet in praise. In the end, it seems to me that at least sometimes God moves the obstacles and stirs the waters. Number two, Jesus uses proxies to prod us to the pool. I had accepted the outcome. It was as if Jesus had asked, "Do you want to be made well?" And I responded, "Of course I do, but my doctors say that won't be happening." But Jackie, my wife, was not convinced for 5 years, unbeknownst to me, and with nary a single reply. She had emailed the lead surgeon at UCSD pleading our case. When I asked the surgeon the night before the surgery what had led to the reversal, he looked at Jackie in the eye, he looked at me, and he said, "Persistence. Persistence." I might well have entitled this sermon "The Parable of the Persistent Nearly Widow." She moved for me the obstacles. She stirred the waters. And frankly, I'm not certain whom I should thank first, Jesus or Jackie. For those of you who are partnered, can you even imagine the unspeakable joy of thanking your spouse for saving your life? Number three, we can pick up our mat or not. In the end, we face a choice. One Sunday morning years ago, I asked my congregation to share their favorite Bible verses, and one woman rose proudly and said in a strong, clear voice, "God helps those who help themselves." I know I'm in a Baptist church because you know that's not in the Bible. In a Presbyterian church, I'm not sure they would know, so... Suffice it to say, I never did that again, and I wasn't sure what to do in that moment. Should I embarrass her publicly by explaining that that's not actually in the Bible? But I reflected on her misunderstanding. Perhaps what is true is that God helps us to help ourselves. Do you want to be healed? Now, there's a question for the ages. I am convinced that short of tornadoes and car wrecks, most of us actually have some say about when we die. 30 years of pastoral ministry acquainted me with many people who, at the end of their lives, have quietly chosen to let go. The time comes when it is no longer possible to pick up our mats. When I was dying, I learned that there are worse things than death. When the shadows have grown long and when the body is weary and the Christian is ready, Jesus is surely as present as he was beside the pool long ago. And in that situation, it is a loving and gracious gift to whisper into the ears of our family and friends, "We'll be all right. You go on. We'll see you later." In my case, after surgery, it was time to pick up my mat. The spiritual trick is knowing when is when. Resolving to die is an unspeakably personal decision. Number four, friends and congregations are God's life preservers. By the way, if you ever need affirmation, announce your impending death. People say the nicest things. It's like attending your own funeral day after day. And then when you see them again, you can just hear the inner dialogue. "Oh no, what do I say now? Isn't he supposed to be dead?" That's quite embarrassing. I wonder how Lazarus handled the social awkwardness. Friends and congregations form networks of affirmation, prayer, and caregiving that are nothing short of life-giving, and in my case, life-saving. Never doubt that the prayers you offer for another, or the notes that you send to another, or the time you spend with another, are redemptive. They can actually be even salvific. By the way, your Tuesday morning prayer group has prayed for us for years. How can we possibly express our deep gratitude? One of the other things that I learned was the importance, in my case, of male friendships. I had a cadre of male friends, including Ryan, your pastor, who never forgot me, who continued to make visits to me, was sitting in my hospice bed in my master bedroom. I don't know how I will ever express the gratitude that I feel for that network of care. Speaking of which, number five, and the things I have learned when I was dying, express your affections now. It's such a cliche truism to say, tell people what you feel about them because you might not be here tomorrow or they might get hit by a bus. It's such a cliche, I'm embarrassed to offer it. Except that it's so true. There is a deeper reason that we share our respect and affirmations other than the fear that one of us might disappear before tomorrow. We share our respect and affirmations with friends and family because it is life-giving to hear that we are appreciated, loved, and admired by others. It also feels good to tell people that you love them and what you respect about them, no matter their startled expressions. Our culture does not encourage such emotional intimacy, but still the truth is that heartfelt affirmations build stronger people and families, congregations and nations. Don't wait until you're dying or they are. Tell them now that you love them and what you love about them and what you appreciate about them. Number six, nurses will see you naked. Get over it. Number seven. Just glide right past that. Yeah. Anything else I would say would be too much information. Number seven, sometimes it is more blessed to receive. The Apostle Paul quoted Jesus as saying that it is more blessed to give than to receive. This has been distilled into an ethic of service and selflessness that brings for many of us feelings of guilt should we ever need to receive. And that's a problem. Because sometimes all of us need to receive. I've always wanted to be a giver. I wanted to contribute more than I would draw. I pledge regularly to National Public Radio and to public television, primarily because I don't want to feel like a mooch. When we go out to eat with friends, I do my best to get the credit card to the waiter first. My friends won't tell you that that's true, but that's at least try. Paul's quoting Jesus about giving bounces around my soul like gumballs in a penny candy machine. That thought is just always there, but I'm supposed to give before I receive. That said, my health experience has laid bare for me the illusion that we may only give and not receive. Jackie and I would not have made it without the help of our family and friends and church family. Meals, cards, texts, prayers, and yes, money kept us going. My surgery was exceedingly costly, and I feel like I should write an open letter to the American taxpayer and to get to say thanks for Medicare, which bore the brunt of a surgery and a 26-day hospital bill that came just shy of $900,000. How could we possibly have done that? Thank you to all of you who pay your taxes. Dying actually taught me the beauty of being dependent upon others. If you have difficulty asking for help, I encourage you to try it. There are many valuable lessons to be learned when we depend on others. I am convinced that as we have each been created in the image of God, that people are intrinsically good, given half a chance to be. And when we receive help from others as they offer it, we do service because we give them the chance to be good. Learn to receive help. Number 8, gratitude is the heart of all Christian faith. You've heard the old aphorism that there are no atheists in a foxhole. Well, I've long believed that there are no atheists at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Because to say thank you before a meal is, no matter how shakily we say it, to affirm a belief that the gifts of life come from something other and larger than us. To say thank you is implicitly a religious declaration of faith. And I am convinced it is the bedrock of all subsequent faith. Gratitude is the heart of what it means to be a Christian. The old adage that we are to count our blessings, actually pretty good advice. Counting our blessings, being grateful for them, reminds us to be thankful for what we have and not covetousness, not covet what we don't have. Number 9, this will sound strange coming from a minister. Christianity is true. At the risk of giving away trade secrets, let me share that sometimes even pastors have doubts. I preached the gospel for 30 years, and in the days following my terminal diagnosis, I was startled by the realization that, holy moly, I actually believe all this stuff. I wasn't conscious of doubting God, but there's something about a terminal diagnosis that can send you either into a whirlwind of doubt or it can place you beside still waters. In other words, a terminal diagnosis can be the proof in the pudding. For me, there was no internal dialogue saying, what the heck, I might as well embrace what I've been preaching. It was rather a deep-hearted realization that what I thought I believed, I truly believed. My faith became something, much more than convictions or beliefs. My faith revealed itself as trust. And I realized all will be well. I trust that in life and in death, I belong to God, and I will be okay, and my family will be okay. Jesus Christ, the unique Son of God, died and rose again, and because of that, we too will be lifted into the very heart of God. I trust these ideas. It's just not that I believe them. I trust them to be true. But more, I trust that God is real, that God is present, that God is good. Number 10, God is present. Now that sounds like something a minister would say, doesn't it? We've all been taught that from the time we were children, that God is present. But how many times have you come into difficulty and you've asked God for something specific, to be healed or for some solution to a problem? You wanted God to intervene, not just to be present. And you think to yourself, well, presence is great, but couldn't you do something more tangible, God? I learned to trust and to take great comfort in that idea that God is present. You know, it's been argued that humanity's chief fear is death. I don't think that's true. I think humanity's chief fear is isolation. It's loneliness. In fact, if you believe in hell, imagine an eternal banishment of loneliness. Imagine such a thing. So perhaps the thing about God we most want to be true is precisely that God is present. If God is with us, we are never alone. We never need fear isolation. At church and at the grocery store or in the hospice bed, we are not alone. In fact, upon reflection, I actually didn't actually learn much when dying that I didn't already know. So perhaps the sermon is mistitled. Most of them are, by the way. That's because most preachers write the sermon through the week and title the sermon at the beginning of the week. I came into church one morning and someone had seen the bulletin and said, "Oh, I'm really looking forward to the sermon," because I looked at the title and I said, "That's fine, but it makes me wish the sermon had something to do with the title." But what I mean is that I don't know that I so much learned these top 10 things as I remembered them. Which is to say to you that should you have the misfortune of receiving a terminal diagnosis, fear not. Because the chances are very good that you know everything that you already need to know to weather the dying process. We've been taught the things we need to know from the time we were little children in church. And that's when I learned that all of those years I had been making deposits into a reservoir of faith that I could then make withdrawals from. And everything I needed to know was already there. I could add other lessons: the importance of community, the role of prayer, the redemptive nature of a good and healthy marriage. I could add many things, but as I mentioned, you already know the things you need to know. As it turns out, I did also. I am forever a changed man. I think I am more relaxed and more calm and more trusting. I will be a better friend and a better husband and a better father because of this experience. And I think actually a better disciple as well. There's nothing like a terminal diagnosis to help remind you what really matters. And many of the busy things that kept me occupied seem now to have been frivolous and unimportant. But now I have a clarity of vision that will guide the rest of my days. The number one word I would offer about the rest of my days is gratitude. How in the world will I live my life in such a way as to thank God for God's faithfulness? Because I'm not dead yet. Sometimes it's overwhelming to me. And I don't know what God has for me in the next chapter. And God is exceedingly subtle and I wish God would be more forthcoming about what's up for me next. Maybe more preaching. We'll see. Maybe another book. We'll see. But of this I am certain. I will be part of a worshiping community week in and week out for the rest of my life. For that is the marrow of faith's bones. And that is what saved us in these last 4.5 years. So remember, everything that you need to know, you already know. And should you have the misfortune of receiving such a diagnosis, all will be well. You belong to God in life and in death. Thanks be to God.